So today I want to talk about a problem that is neither fish nor fowl, in the sense that it's neither really applied nor is it really mathematics. But I'm going to tell it anyway. It's a story that pleases me enormously. So you have to think, for the moment at least, about the possibility of making a convex combination between the title that Tudor gave for me and the wonderful title that Graham Brown used for a paper in 1911, which was Intrinsic Factors in the Act of Progression of the Mammal. So what might that mean? It means about patterns such as walking and the intrinsic factors that go into walking and or breathing and or the operation of an internal combustion engine or a number of other things in which intrinsically cyclic behavior produces unbounded behavior. So a sort of a control theory prototype of that is provided by an equation like so, where, let's say to begin with, x is Rn valued and u, well, let's take that, let's take m, and u is Rn valued. And we have, this is really also expressible as di of x ui, I equals 1 to n. And the wonderful thing about an equation like this is that all the things over here, b of x and u, can all remain bounded forever, and elements of x itself can grow without bound. And if you think about that, that's what you like to do with things that you can afford to buy. For example, an automobile has got everything bounded. It's 22 feet long or something like that. Nothing gets very big. But you can go 3,000 miles. So what you would like to do is you would like to have situations in which bounded stuff generates unbounded stuff. Bounded stuff is cheaper. Unbounded stuff is useful. So if I say that also in terms of breathing, what we'd like to do is to take sort of the unbounded amount of oxygen in the atmosphere, filter it through our bodies in an unending stream. So again, we're trying to get the total amount of oxygen that we assimilate over our lifetime to be huge, even though our lungs have finite capacity and so forth. So what the way this is achieved ordinarily is through patterns. Patterns of breathing, patterns of walking, patterns of engineering objects. And what I want to talk about today in particular is how do you stabilize patterns like that. So if this theory gets worked out right, we will have a way to a sort of a prototype of how you regulate patterns in that sense. So this is what control people do for a living. They make things stable and they try to understand generically how you would stabilize things and occasionally actually do things specific. So what does this model have to say about this problem? Well, the easiest example of this is the following one. It's one problem I'm going to generalize slightly in a moment, but suppose I split this old vector x into two pieces. Suppose I have a set of equations x dot equals ui, so psi dot equals ui, and then I have a bunch of other equations, zij dot equals, now I'm going to take a special choice for b of x, and it's going to be x transpose, xu transpose minus ux transpose, like so. So in terms of coordinates, this just says, skew symmetric. Skew symmetric matrix. So in terms of coordinates, zij dot equals xi xj dot minus xj xi dot. So this is quite easy to understand situation, is I have in X space here, I have some curve, and in ZIJs, I can imagine that that curve is projected onto three planes here. And if I draw a chord from the end of the curve back, like so, then the area of this projected onto these components, shouldn't have drawn that, this area marks the change in the ZIJ. So to make the ZIJs advance, you can, for example, go around in circles, and Z will then advance in a steady way as you generate area. So this is a prototype of cyclical processes that are bounded, producing things that are unbounded. Okay? Good. Now, I don't like to write these equations this way anymore. So what I'd like to do is to suggest both a neater way to write them and package this a little bit differently. So suppose that I just remind you that if I have a Lie algebra, I might be able to write it as the sum of two pieces that have the property that makes this a grading, that is to say, L0, L0 gives me something back in L0, L1, L0 gives me something in L1, and L1 and L1 give me something in back in L0. Now, my only example of this that I want to give right now is if I take the Lie algebra of SON plus 1 and I split it as a n vector x, a skew symmetric matrix Z, and complete it in that way, that then this looks like 0, L1, L1, L0. And it behaves in this way. And moreover, this allows me to write the equations that I've been writing up there in the following way. G dot equals, if I let pi 1 and pi 0 be the projections onto these spaces, then this looks like pi 1 of G bracketed with U plus U, where I imagine that U lives in L1 and G is 0 minus X transpose X. All right, so this equation here then becomes equivalent to the one that I've written up there, and everything I said about that applies to this equation. This becomes then a prototype of the phenomenon that I talked about before, namely where stuff on this side of the equation remains bounded, things over here can grow without bound. To make that happen, you've got to make U follow a pattern. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is I'd like to understand the most efficient patterns to achieve something. So one way to define efficient pattern is to say, let's call this optimal patterns. So we can look at some measure of effort as being some inner product like so. If you want, you can think of this as the killing form. If you want to think about it in terms of matrices, you can think about it as a trace inner product. So you pick some time and you say, let's minimize this subject to the constraint that g of 0 equals a given and g of t equals given. So this, just proceeding with the variational equation, just to write it down, notice that from my first equation here, that I can express u as pi 1 g dot, because the grading condition, this was belonging to L1, this belonged to L1, bracket it together to get something in L0. This, however, is in L1. They're perpendicular, so g dot pi g dot equals u. So I can rewrite this as integral 0 to t of pi 1 g, and dot. But I have to add in with Lagrange multiplier the conditions on the rest of g. So the conditions on the rest of g would be to take something which I'll call lambda, which belongs in L0, interproduct it with the term here, pi 1 g times u, or now pi 1 g dot. Okay, so that then is what the Lagrangian looks like. And if you work out the Euler-Lagrange equation, taking advantage of the fact that you can flip the inner product over in the standard way, you'll get pi 1 of g double dot plus, possibly readjusting the constant, bracket lambda g dot, pi 1 g dot, equals 0. So this is the Euler-Lagrange equation associated with the most efficient way to generate patterns. I want to integrate that once before I put a box around it. So if I do that, I'll get pi 1 g dot plus lambda pi 1 g, it's a dot there, plus a constant k equals 0. Where does this constant k live? The constant k, of course, lives in L1. This constant lambda lives in L0. And so now I'll put a box around that. And this then becomes the way to describe the variational solutions as the most efficient patterns. However, one of the things that I find is difficult for mathematicians to appreciate about control theory is that this is not a very interesting thing all by itself. The reason it's not very interesting all by itself is because this variational equation solves an optimization problem, but unless one can show that the overall dynamics are somehow stable, it isn't very useful. If you have a heart that works really, really well, if you're at absolute zero and nobody says anything to you, it isn't very useful. You have to have something that has robustness with respect to disturbances. So this variational formulation doesn't build in any kind of robustness. And for that reason, I want to massage this a little bit and put it back into this equation and then start to address the question of how do we make these good solutions, that is good from the point of view of minimum effort, how do we make them regulate themselves? All right, so put this back up into the equation for g, and we get g dot, and now instead of writing pi 1 and pi 0, I'm just going to write g1 and g0 because it saves a little bit of writing. And so if I put that in there, I'll get G1 and then U. Well, what is U? U is pi 1 G dot. So, because after all, I get that from this equation. So pi 1 G dot is lambda, and here we have another pi 1 G, so it becomes G1, plus our K, that gets bracketed, plus lambda G1 plus K. And now I can simplify this just a little bit. If I feel free to change the sign of lambda whenever it suits me, I'll write this as G1, G1 times lambda plus G1 bracketed with K, but then I'm also going to have G1 bracketed with lambda. So if I flip the sign of lambda, that just becomes G1 bracketed with a constant, now no longer in either L0 or L1, just a constant. K wiggle plus K, where K does belong in L1. So now this then becomes the form of the geodesic equation for, or the optimization problem here. So, I mean, other people might want to think of this as the sub-Riemannian geodesic associated with this problem. So it has this nice double bracket form, but it has a graded structure on top of it. So we need just one more piece of data. Now, many people in the room have experience with the equation x dot equals x bracket n, and its Poisson properties. This is a first cousin of that. All right, so this would, in principle, generate patterns. What would the patterns depend upon? They depend upon the initial condition, and they would depend upon these constants, K wiggle and K. Let's have now a look at a special case to see how we might alter these equations in such a way as to give those patterns some structure and give them some stability. Before I do that, however, what I should say is that we know quite a bit about the solutions of this equation. Namely, we know the following thing. There exists a constant matrix S belonging to L0, such that if I take G minus ST, and I call that E, then E is almost periodic, and I can give you a formula, we'll give you later on a formula for the element S, but the reason that this is fruitful for our current purposes is that if we have a desire to make Z12 increase monotonically like so, if we then set ST as being the target, so think of ST as being the target function, you require a certain respiratory rate, you want the depth of your breathing and the frequency of your breathing to be something stable that will sustain that respiratory rate, so S would be something that would be given to you, a walking rate, so forth, and E would be the difference, it's the error between what you want to have, namely that thing, and what you actually have. So if I write this if I alter this equation by writing it in terms of E, nothing very much happens. I get E dot equals G1, sorry, E1 bracket E1 lambda plus E1 bracket K wiggle. Now the only thing that happens is that K gets added to it, subtracted from it, this element S. So this then becomes the equation that describes the deviation between what you want and what you have. And the calculation here that I haven't shown says that, all right, fine, this is an almost periodic function, so it's bounded. And it, in fact, would be periodic if the eigenvalues of lambda are rationally related. So the only, it's e to the lambda t that are giving you the fundamental frequencies present in this equation, and that's the most interesting qualitative feature of this equation. Now, I still haven't told you how to think about making this into a nicely regulated periodic solution. So, how should we do that? Well, let's look at an example. So, the simplest example of the thing that I talked about clear back at the beginning was where n is two-dimensional and z then becomes just the space of 2x2 skew symmetric matrices, so it's a one-dimensional Lie algebra. So I'll write the notation this way: x dot equals u, y dot equals v, z dot equals xv minus yu. If I work through all this theory, in this case, the equations of motion can be written down, and I would have a problem like this if I said I would like z desired is, let's say, alpha t. I'd like z to just grow like alpha t, and I would like some kind of pattern in u and v that does it. Well, your first thought, I believe, would be to say, well, fine, let's, since I know that z is the area generated by x and y, let's pick some curve here that goes around in a circle. If I look at the variational theory, it turns out that the best curve is simply a circle. This is a historically important problem because it was perhaps the first problem in the calculus of variations that was solved. It's equivalent to the isoperimetric problem of finding the shortest perimeter of a figure that encompasses a certain area. So the best thing to do is have x and y go in circles. We can generate those either by a pattern generator, as one often hears about in biology, or you can try to generate them spontaneously from the variables themselves. I'm going to take the second point of view because it's a little bit more interesting. And to say that these are spontaneously generated, I might take a lambda here and a minus lambda here and a zero and x and y. So this would be a differential equation that generated a circle and would cause z to advance. But I don't want z to advance too rapidly. In fact, if I do that, the equation for z dot becomes simply lambda times x squared plus y squared minus alpha. If I put in the fact that I want to track alpha t, then this becomes the error. We'll call it e before. There's no need to change now. So if I had this equation, you can see that if I have some factors that involve the initial conditions of x and y, and they are confused with the value of lambda. So I have to figure out a way to make the solution that I want stable. So one thing you could do is to say, look, if I'm gaining area too fast, I can simply decrease it by X and Y. Now we have a perfectly sensible control law here that says if this is growing too fast, then we will shut down X and Y, and this will spiral in. So, and then this will stop growing. This negativeness will take over, and then we will see E growing again, and in fact, this solution will then grow, and we will recover ourselves. Perfectly good solution. So what do you just, I can't match the bottle of our previous speaker, but since he left it here, I could offer it again. However, what do you think? Does this work? Sounds like it should work, but well, you're absolutely right. If at some level, what this will generate is a limit cycle. I find that, well, it does generate a limit cycle. I'll show you that in a second. I was actually hoping that one of the control theory people in the crowd would say that they were certain that it was going to work. It doesn't work for the following reason. If you let R equals, let R equals X squared plus Y squared, then you can discover that R equals 2ZR, and Z dot equals, lambda R minus alpha. Then if you make the change of variables, F equals LN R, you see that in the variables F and Z, this is completely undamped. You might have also gotten some clue from the following thing, is if you read the psychology literature, what you'll find is that one thing that people like to study about walking is the rate at which, when you want to walk faster, you both increase your stride and increase your frequency, and when you want to walk slower, you decrease the stride and decrease the frequency. If you put a frequency correction term in here, so minus alpha z, lambda minus alpha z, then that has the effect of putting a minus alpha zr term in here, and now you've got damping in both the z term, as you have an exponential decay factor in both the z term and the e term, and this works perfectly nicely. What does it look like? Well, if you plot time here and our three variables of interest, x, y, and z here, then what will happen with x and y, of course, is that they have to oscillate, because otherwise you can't get any area generated for z. So they oscillate, and they oscillate out of phase. Z will initially overshoot very badly, but then it will come down and settle out, doing exactly what the system is supposed to do. And one doesn't have to apologize here for the fact that it doesn't settle out until you've had a few cycles. Think of that as baby's first breath. It takes a while to get started, and then things work fine. Sorry, E does that. Yes, I'm sorry. All right, so this is a nice little story, and if the only thing one cared about were problems in which you had one cyclic variable, that would be fine. But there are quite a number of other problems that are of interest. For example, when horses locomote, as in intrinsic factors in the progression of the mammal, they change their stride from depending on the rate. So there's not just a smooth change, but there's also a qualitative change in what happens in the pattern. And what would you have to do to develop a theory that had elements of that qualitative change. Well, of course, there's not much opportunity here in this one-dimensional problem, but on the other hand, very few things are one-dimensional. Human body is 200-dimensional, at least, and so one would not like to just limit the analysis's applicability to this one-dimensional problem. So what I want to do is I want to recast this ad hoc thing that we invented for this purpose. I'd like to recast that in a way that's consistent with the notation of the graded Lie algebra, and then that will put in front of us a more general model, which we can hope to understand. Good. So how do I Lieify this stuff here? Well, some of the terms are easy, some of the terms require a little bit of thought, but it helps to just do the calculation that, let's do it this way. If I bracket this with minus A transpose A, zero, that's going to equal omega A minus omega A transpose 0, 0. So if I want to produce the effect of omega times x here, all I have to do, so that is to replicate this kind of a term, all I have to do is to bracket it with a constant like this. So I can see that this term here, the lambda part of it, will go over to bracket 0, 0, something in pi 0, something in L0, bracketed with 0 minus x transpose x0. So that's easy enough, and I could put z there as well. So looking now for a control law. So the control law is given by this side of the equation. And I have to put together these terms. So u now thought of as an element of L1 instead of thought of as a point in R2 is going to be 0, 0, 0 lambda minus z bracketed with pi 1 of g. That is, I don't have to write that anymore. So that takes care of this term. As far as this term is concerned, well, we have to somehow take this skew symmetric guy z and convert it into a diagonal matrix. So one way to do that is to take a constant omega and multiply it by it. But that doesn't look like something you can do in a Lie algebra setting, but you, in fact, can do that here because of the grading. So z omega plus omega z, these are both skew symmetric. This is going to be symmetric. I want to generate this term, perhaps of 1/2 if you want, but I'll absorb that in the constant. And that's going to be the way I generate this term. So how do I generate this? I can simply use this trick a couple times. Let me write it out for one of these. So then I would write plus 0, 0, 0, z bracketed with 0, 0, 0, lambda bracketed with 0x0. All right, so then what it boils down to is we get here a g0 term, and if I reverse these and change the sign of lambda again, I'll get a g1 term and then a lambda term for this, and I'll add to that the terms that I have up here, which were simply 0, 0, 0, lambda minus z, bracketed with g1, and that is a control law that's expressed completely in terms of our problem data, and it captures this one as a special case, and in this special case, things were stable. So,
do you have to say something about, I mean, the self-interaction could give you a t-growth, but also resonances between the various components could give you a t-growth.
Thank you. yes, so I'm going to talk about, before embracing this control law, we want to be cognizant of exactly the things that you say. So, how do we, what kind of hope can we have for a control law like this, which after all only works in one special case? Or we only know it to work in one special case. All right, so let me go back now to the variational problem again. I wrote down the Euler Lagrange equations for it. And it sits here. But this problem is beguiled by a huge number of symmetries. And in fact, it's best perhaps to think about those symmetries in the context of the notation x dot equals u and z dot equals x u transpose minus u x transpose. You see that in this case, the group action of theta on x, so x goes into theta x, sends z into theta z theta transpose, but it sends u into u. So the trajectories that were optimal before can be computed in this new coordinate system. They will remain optimal. So that means that if we focus our attention on, and we can do this without loss of generality, focus attention on x0 equals 0, z0 equals 0, and then ask ourselves about how it depends upon the constants x1 and z1, you see that, first of all, because the x variables in my problem are only helper variables, they are the things like the position of your leg, which you don't really care about. What you care about is how fast is your nose advancing. So these variables you might as well regard as being periodic. In fact, you have to regard them as periodic, and that means I've set them at zero. And Z1 is then an arbitrary skew symmetric matrix. But if I want to minimize the amount of work I have to do, I might as well take Z1 to be block diagonal, because after all, through this transformation here, I can always put it in block diagonal form. And so forth. So here's then becomes the question. Think about the projected areas interpretation of the curve. So I have some curve in X space, which is now a closed curve, and it projects on to each of these pieces. And of course, this is happening now in a space, the ambient space is n-dimensional. So there's n times n minus 1 over 2 projected areas, and most of them are on the off diagonals, and a few of them are on the on diagonals, roughly n over 2. Let's say n is even for the moment, just because that's enough for today. If n is even, then I have the diagonal projected areas that I care about, n over 2 of those, and I have these off-diagonal elements that I have to make sure are zero. This is your point. I have to make sure these are zero. Now, the solutions to the Euler-Lagrange equations here are all sinusoids. What am I looking at here? I'm looking at the following problem, is that the sinusoids that produce the forward motion in this block, in the Z1-2 block, have got to be orthogonal to the ones that work in the Z2-3 or 3-4 block, and have to be orthogonal to the ones in the NN-1 block. So in order for these sinusoids to be orthogonal, they've got to be of different frequencies. This is very much like exclusion principle in physics, and it looks even more like it if you do this not in SON but in the special unitary group. You cannot reuse sinusoids. So if you then limit this Euler-Lagrange equation that I had, x double dot plus lambda x dot equals zero. So that was the original form of the Euler-Lagrange equation for this, but now in the vector case, that means that this matrix lambda, first of all, to make this periodicity condition true, its eigenvalues have got to be such that e to the lambda t is periodic. So e to the lambda t equals I. That fixes the eigenvalues to within an integer multiple. And then the rest of z is going to be determined by the initial conditions on the vector x. So with a lambda that has the property that it looks like 0, lambda 1, minus lambda 1, 0, and so forth, down the diagonal, these are constrained to be lambda 1 and then 2 lambda 1 and n over 2 lambda 1, multiples of each other, to make sure that, to ensure those are 0 off the diagonal. Now, is there any efficiency or inefficiency associated with the higher frequencies? And the answer is yes, because you're minimizing x dot squared. That is to say, u squared was x dot squared. So when you generate these higher frequencies, that means that you increase x dot. And so what it works out is that the cost to get to a particular z, the cost to get to a z, which is the same as the cost to create an advance that we're talking about there, that is given by a formula that's proportional to I lambda I. Lambdas are complex, purely imaginary, of course. Take their magnitudes, and now the ith one gets weighted by I, and that's then multiplied by the size of the z that we want to reach, so times a zi-like quantity. So the amount of growth we want multiplied by I. Well, so the growth is actually, so let mu I equal eigenvalues of zt. Mu I, then this becomes summation I mu I. So in order to minimize this quantity, what you would like to do is to pair the largest eigenvalues with the lowest frequencies, the next largest with the next lowest frequency, and so forth. So the optimal way to get a growth pattern in this matrix sense is to use sinusoids, allocate the sinusoids in such a way as the one that requires the maximum amplitude should get the lowest frequency, and so on. Good. So now, as I started to say before we embrace this formula here without regret, we should say something about, we should understand that we're going to have to force the off-diagonal elements here to be non-resonant in this sense. And the on-diagonal ones will then have to be adjusted in such a way as to produce the magnitudes that we want, but the adjustment should respect this resonance condition. So we'd expect to have one overall adjustment of the frequencies, and to do the fine tuning in terms of the size of the vector x. So what I would expect to happen in this case, although I don't know that it'll happen, what I would expect to happen is that you would have one adjustment of the frequency so that things would remain locked in frequency at all times, and then you would have more adjustments of the type that's shown up by this term, in which the individual pairs of oscillators, elements of an oscillator, have their amplitudes adjusted by a mechanism more like this one. So what is the potential of this to explain gate changes? Well, one of the interesting things about this is that if you were in a domain in which you have require the largest component here initially, then you would want this frequency to be the largest and this or smallest, and this one would be twice as big as it. On the other hand, if you then move to a different mode of operation in which the amplitude required here was bigger, you would then see a qualitative change in what the optimal trajectories were. Instead of the trajectories going around once in these variables as it went twice in the others, you would see a reversal of that. And so there is the potential in this kind of a theory to predict that kind of qualitative change in pattern as you go through regimes that call for different amplitudes of the total growth. What does this have to do with the Weyl group? This little story here about the symmetries here make it apparent that if you explained all this in a Lie theoretic language, that you would say, well, it's enough to understand this problem when ZT is an element of a Cartan subalgebra, and that in that Cartan we would have some kind of a partial ordering, as one does in Lie theory, and that this ordering of the sizes could be interpreted in terms of that ordering, and the trajectories that we get remain solutions of the Euler-Lagrange equation even when we upset the most economical ordering here. They still are solutions, but they're no longer minimizers. So an interesting little sketch, and then I'll stop, is to say, what does the geodesic ball look like for this equation in terms of the only thing that matters, namely the eigenvalues of ZT? Well, it has the following picture. Looks like the star-shaped thing, where the slopes of these lines are in the ratio of 1 to 2. And this then, if I took the geodesic ball in for the case where x is four-dimensional, and I sliced it through in such a way as to expose the plane in which the eigenvalues lived, then in terms of the eigenvalues, lambda 1 and lambda 2 ordered any old way, this would be the set of points that are equally distant from the origin. And if I construct a line through here like this, I get something that I can think of as a Weyl chamber. And by solving the variational problem here, I get all the solutions by the action of the solutions there under the Weyl group. But I'm only interested in that insofar as it helps me understand how to generalize this formula and to try to understand what additional terms needed to be added there, if any. But I think my time's up. Is that correct?